Welcome to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program featuring conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
My book is about the state of feminism today, and especially about the ways in which academic women need to think about the issues of feminism to address the real concerns of what, for lack of a better phrase, we might call real women in the real world. It is an attempt to bring a bit of common sense to very
Is it possible to say that Western feminism in any sense furnishes a model for feminism in the Middle East? Where do the ideas come from?
Not as far as I know, because all the women I interviewed in the book, I asked them one question. What do you think of Western woman liberation? And the answer always was, we don't want Western woman liberation. We want a different kind of liberation, Arab woman liberation. Now, I have to clarify that as the Western world...
Feminism, East and West, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with Elizabeth Fox Genovese of Emory University and Buthaina Shaban of the University of Damascus. I'll talk first with Elizabeth Fox Genovese about her new book, Feminism Without Illusions. Following that, Buthaina Shaban will discuss her new book, entitled Both Right and Left-Handed, Arab Women Talk About Their Lives. Elizabeth Fox Genovese directs the Women's Studies Program at Emory University. Her recent book is Feminism Without Illusions, A Critique of Individualism, published by the University of North Carolina Press. I asked Elizabeth Fox Genovese to describe feminism in the 1990s and its interactions with contemporary American political culture. Elizabeth Fox Genovese.
First of all, I think the most productive work that feminists could do would be to work with the mainstream parties. There has been a strong tendency to associate feminism with the Democratic Party. I am beginning to see signs of the emergence of a serious conservative feminism. I think its numbers are not, no, it is not an oxymoron. I see what's coming.
Right.
There's some real serious people out there who are going to argue that women's issues are indeed serious.
We're talking about what, the in 1990s, the daughters of Edmund Burke, people who are of a philosophically, culturally conservative cast of mind, and yet nonetheless can argue cogently for the rights of women.
Absolutely.
All right, now elaborate on that for me.
Well, one strand, it is not yet a coherent movement. Let me make that perfectly clear. But you are beginning to see a number of women who would call themselves feminists who also call themselves conservatives. For them, the most important issues are the economic plight of women in the wake of no-fault divorce, the rights of and care for children, the opportunity for women to mother without stringent economic penalties. I think they can be moved towards a serious consideration of health care, especially as it impacts on women.
All right. Now, what I hear you saying, Betsy Fox Genovese, is that we have a kind of mom and apple pie and the good old days, a sort of nostalgic view of what the idealization of women or women's role in our society, coupled with a very progressive economic kind of thinking. Is that a fair characterization? Again, equal wages, fair treatment in the marketplace, that sort of thing?
Look, again, yes and no. None of this is simple. Where the economic issues are concerned, conservative feminists, I think, and let me say clearly that I am not claiming absolutely to speak for them, but as I read what they're writing, they would argue for equal opportunity. They would argue that the job discrimination that still existed in the 60s and early 70s was unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
That women's inability to get credit in their own names was unacceptable. You go on down the list.
Right.
And then they would argue that those goals have largely been met. They would, in other words, favor a stark, individualistic, and free market-based mm-hmm. program in affirmative action. They would oppose comparable worth. They would oppose anything that smacked of quotas, reverse discrimination,
right.
preferential hiring in order to meet the characteristics of a local demographic base.
All right, now let's spin out one thread here following a word that you have just used, Betsy Fox Genovese, individualism. You say that your book is called Feminism Without Illusions, and the subtitle is, give it to me in its exact phrasing here, A Feminist Critique of Individualism. Have I got that right?
It's a critique of individualism.
All right, a critique of individualism. Tell me about the interplay between feminism as you understand it and individualism. What's going on there?
All right. To begin with, feminism, modern feminism, began with the birth of modern individualism, mm-hmm. and it would take too much time.
The rights of man.
That's right. Yeah. The great 18th century revolutions, American, French, and I would include Haitian.
Okay.
Mary Wollstonecraft argued for the rights of woman mm-hmm. to go along with the rights of man. That is a very important strand in modern feminism, mm-hmm. equality for women, equal rights for women. And that aspect of feminism has gradually gained momentum through the 19th and 20th centuries, and women do now have the vote. Mm-hmm. They can now get credit in their own names. They can work in pretty much any aspect of the public sphere. Discrimination against women is covert. It is not legal.
Mm-hmm. All
okay?
right. All right. So what's happened to that? Why does that deserve to be criticized from a feminist perspective?
Lots of feminists from different perspectives are arguing very forcefully that that model is inadequate for women.
All right, and here we go back to the reasons that you were ticking off just a moment ago. We have maybe an equity in the marketplace, and yet, but we have nonetheless covert forms of discrimination.
Furthermore, women bear children.
Mm-hmm.
The theoretical problem for feminism is: are women individuals, or are they different?
Right, and what do you say to that? Just let's pause on that for a moment. I mean, when we come to sexual difference, gender difference, how do you come down on that sort of thing?
I am impressed by the claims of sexual difference. Women can bear children, men cannot bear children. I suspect that women's and men's experience of sexuality is different and will remain different.
Uh-huh. So we have gender as a social construct set against or complementing somehow on a spectrum here in relationship to sexuality as a biological construct.
Exactly. And gender would be the social construction mm-hmm. of biology or sexuality. That has become the stock phrase. The debates about it have become heated and confused, but let's take that as given. And the question I ask in my book is, if we accept sexual difference, then could we not turn our attention to what its social consequences should be?
All right, and let's stop on that for a moment. What directions should we take? What threads, again, should we tease out when we want these answers?
Well, the common wisdom, and it wasn't all oppressive and unfair throughout up to the 19th century and through the 19th century, was that men's physical strength, especially upper body strength, suited them for certain kinds of work. There was a direct connection between men's physiology and the roles they performed in society. Similarly, for women who had to bear a lot of children, frequently more children than they wanted in the end, because some would die as infants.
Right.
The connections were clear. What I argue is that in our own time, between technological change and contraceptive change, most of the connections we are used to drawing are irrelevant. And indeed, if we want to look at men's physical strength as dictating the social roles that men should perform, then I think we should acknowledge that men belong in construction crews and professional sports and leave CEOs' desks right. to women.
Well, do we look for moral and political and economic analogs to these sexual differences between men and women?
I'm not tremendously impressed with the analogs myself. I assume you're getting at the strand in feminism that argues that women speak in a different voice, mm-hmm. reason differently.
They're different.
Would, if given power, order the world more humanely than men, that we are naturally nurturing, gentle, and sweet.
And you don't buy that, or you buy only a part of it? What?
I buy a very small part of it. The underlying argument of my book is that we need to learn to think of individual right as the product of collective life, not prior to it.
Not the creator of it.
Exactly.
Fair enough.
Nor the final standard of legitimation for it.
Uh-huh.
What I want for our daughters, and I include our students and the young women towards whom we feel responsible, mm-hmm. is a world in which we develop a country, a nation, in which we develop a model of equity for women as members of society, that we get beyond difference versus equality, and that we develop paths of earning a livelihood and participating in families that permits women to do both. We don't penalize women because our children are our highest social good, our most important resource as a society. How we make it possible for women and men to participate in the workforce and in rearing children is, in a sense, the measure of our humanity, our self-image, the ways in which we enact our goals of how we view ourselves as a people.
Betsy Fox Genovese, again, your book is Feminism Without Illusions. It's always a pleasure to have you at the National Humanities Center. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Wayne. It's a pleasure to be here.
Elizabeth Fox Genovese is a professor of history and director of women's studies at Emory University. Her most recent book is Feminism Without Illusions, published by the University of North Carolina Press. Elizabeth Fox Genovese is also the author of Within the Household Plantation, Black and White Women of the Old South. You're listening to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program featuring conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Feminism East and West continues. I'll talk next with Buthaina Shaban, a professor of English at the University of Damascus. Buthaina Shaban is the author of both Right and Left-Handed, Arab Women Talk About Their Lives, recently published by Indiana University Press. In her new book, Buthaina Shaban treats a number of themes relating to women in the Middle East, including war and militarism, Islamic laws and social values, and the place of Arab women in the professional world. She characterizes them as both right and left-handed because of the responsibilities they are assuming outside as well as within the family. Buthaina, let's begin with this. My impression, reading the newspapers, might be that feminism in the Middle East is a contradiction. Am I right about this?
Well, I think the term feminism, yes, is quite controversial, particularly in the Middle East, as everything is in the Middle East. There are many aspects and many nuances to feminism. On the one hand, no one wants to identify feminism there with Western feminism because of the prejudice also against the legacy of Western feminism. So this comes handy to suppress feminism in the Middle East. And this also confuses women and feminists.
Is it possible to say that Western feminism in any sense furnishes a model for feminism in the Middle East? Where do the ideas come from?
Not as far as I know, because all the women I interviewed in the book, I asked them one question. What do you think of Western woman liberation? And the answer always was, we don't want Western woman liberation. We want a different kind of liberation, Arab woman liberation. Now, I have to clarify that as the Western world has a mistaken idea about Arab women as being oppressed and submissive and living in harem, the Arab world also has a mistaken idea about Western women as promiscuous and loose and responsible for the breakup of the family, etc.
Well, let's see if we can get behind some of these stereotypes.
Okay.
What does feminism or women's liberation then consist in the Middle East?
Well, it consists first of all, the obligation to keep the family together and to, if possible, fight for equality within the family framework. You can fight for professional equality, for educational equality, but God forbid you ask for living on your own or sexual liberation, for example.
We're talking about half measures here. We're talking about steps in the right direction in terms of, by comparison, with what we call women's liberation in the West.
Yes, I think we're talking about a different kind of liberation because the Arab world is quite different. The culture is very different. The religion is very different. The traditions are very different. So we're really talking about a liberation within that context that does not challenge the culture, but goes along with it.
Well, now, are you mincing words when you say challenge the culture? You're talking about challenging male authority. You're talking about women coming along and saying, I'm going to live my life this way, not the way you tell me.
Well, I think you're raising a very interesting point because it is very difficult to draw the line. Where does this culture serve women's purposes, and where does it really serve only an authoritarian male purpose?
Where did it serve your purposes, Bukhaina?
Well, I think I would like to have a family. I do have a family. I am a married woman with two daughters, and I don't think Western women are responsible for the breakup of the family. I think this is an absolute nonsense. I think this is a prejudice on our part, on the Arab part. But I think to say that we want to be feminists and we want to keep our families is not a bad thing. I think it's for a woman to be a mother if she wants to and to have children and to have home should not be an obstacle in the way of her being equal.
All right. Now, isn't it the case, though, to raise a painful point here, Bukhaina Shaban, that you haven't seen your family for many years, that you had a falling out with your father because you, in effect, decided to live your life rather than the life that he wanted.
I just
want to
make a correction because they made it up with me in 1988.
Oh, well, good. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Here I am. Here I am reading the book and coming away and thinking, oh, my goodness, this awful separation.
I know. No, that now they love me and they love my daughters and they love my husband and it's all fun. But for 6 years, they didn't talk to me, and that was very painful.
That was because you decided to strike out on your own.
That's very true. That's very true. And I think I wasn't diplomatic about it. I went to England, met a man, fell in love with him, brought him back to Syria. I mean, for a woman to bring the man with her and say, hey, this is the man I'm getting married to, is not the usual thing to do in the Arab world.
Do you feel comfortable now, Buthaina Shaban, going back to your home country of Syria? And I mean, do you stand up and announce yourself as a feminist at University of Damascus?
Oh, sure, I do. And I do give public lectures in the country. I mean, I go around in the country.
And you feel no intimidation?
Absolutely none. And in fact, the people are extremely wonderful and extremely receptive to new ideas and to new thoughts. One thing is that I think in the Arab world we have, if you go to Syria or Lebanon, or it's quite different from Saudi Arabia, with full respect to Saudi Arabia.
So we need to break down this notion of a monolithic oppression of women or feminism.
We really do, because the reality of women, whether in Iraq or in Syria or Algeria or Morocco, is very different from the reality of women in Saudi Arabia, because of the nature of being, you know, the place where the Prophet Muhammad was, and because of the nature of the system, it has a peculiar reality to its own. Still, I'm not saying that Saudi women are, you know, living in harem and they are doing nothing. They are there. They are getting an equal education. They are university professor. They are feminists. They are doing everything. But their reality is quite different from the reality of other Arab women.
Let's put a spin on a wonderful old line from Mr. Freud. What is it that Arab women want with respect to feminism?
Well, they want equal rights. They want, I think the only thing that now, as a Syrian woman, I want is for women to be in every place where men are, in the decision-making process.
You think, is that actually happening?
I think it is happening, but slowly. I would like it to happen more quickly. Now we have 25% of our MPs are women in Syria. And we have women ministers, we have women ambassadors, we have army generals. And at the university, there's no problem. We have 40, 50% women professors. So there's no problem at all. But what I want is for women to be in the crucial position. The same thing applies to the United States. Uh-huh. I would like them to be in the decision-making position. I don't think there are enough women here either. What I want to say to American women is that I don't think they have achieved a lot more than what Arab women have achieved.
Uh-huh. Now that comes as quite a surprise.
Well, I think they haven't. I think when it comes to sexual freedom and personal freedom, like to wear what you want to wear and to go and have a boyfriend, this is the only difference that I can see.
But those are superficial?
I think they do not get women anywhere. I think they are important. Uh-huh. I think they are important. I would like my personal freedom. But to have premarital sex and think that this is great and wonderful, and not to have enough women in Congress, and not to have enough women ministers, and not to have enough women who are making the policy of the country, is not enough. I think this is what I want to see. Once they get to the political making position, I hope they are going to make a difference. They are going to make a difference in the war and peace situation. They are going to make a difference in cultural and international understanding.
Well, wait a minute. Aren't we succumbing after a fashion there to the most invidious kinds of stereotypes, that if the world were run by women, it would be a harmonious, soft, sweet place?
No, I'm not saying that. I don't buy that really at all. But I think it is probably not a mistake to say that generally speaking, and now I'm generalizing, generally speaking, perhaps women would think twice about war more than men, simply because they have children and they have husbands and they have, I'm not saying men don't have children, but I think it's a different relationship.
All right, what you're talking about here is the movement from the personal liberation of an individual to the political circumstances that surround it.
Exactly.
Do Arab women generate enough political will, political influence to move these elements along?
Well, I'll tell you, in Syria, we have moved this along to the extent that now we have nurseries, kindergarten, preschool care for every woman, for every child. The car comes to my doorstep, picks up my children in the morning, brings them back in the afternoon.
All right, now who's paying for this?
Is the government.
All right. And, you know, the first question that you might get in this country is this going to bankrupt the system?
No, the system is bankrupt already. No, I'm just joking now, really. I'm just joking. But I think instead of paying for defense and for all other things, they can pay for bringing up the children who are going to be the future generation anyway.
But now wait, Bhuthaina, let's get real, as they say. I mean, defense, militarism, that's the number one ticket. Anywhere in the world, not just the Middle East.
I know, but I think what we as women are fighting for is that if you want me as a citizen to produce, whether in the army or at the university, you've got to provide for my children. I can't do both jobs. So let the government, let people in power make their choices. I think for the women here in the United States to expect them to be professionals and not to have care for children is saying to them, choose, either be mothers or be professionals, which I think is not a choice. I don't think women should be faced with this situation.
Men don't. Men aren't.
Well, men are professional. They don't have to look after their children. Mm-hmm. They don't have to care. And this is a very big issue. This is a political issue that I think all women all over the world have to face. And in the Arab world, this is the crucial issue that we as women are fighting for. We want social services to allow us the freedom that men have to develop ourselves at a professional level, so that we can climb the ladder.
Mm-hmm. Again, Bhuthaina Shaban, your book is both right and left-handed. Arab women talk about their lives. Thanks for coming to the National Humanities Center.
Thank you very much. Thank you for asking me to come.
Bhuthaina Shaban is a professor of English at the University of Damascus. Her new book is both right and left-handed. Arab Women Talk About Their Lives, recently published by Indiana University Press. Bhuthaina Shaban is an editor of Foreign Literature Quarterly and was recently a Fulbright Fellow at Duke University. You're listening to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program featuring conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Feminism in the United States and the Middle East is available on cassette. For a copy of the preceding discussions, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 579. That's program number 579. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program featuring conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, listen for a discussion with one of the South's leading writers. Wayne Pond will talk with Clyde Edgerton about his new book, Killer Diller.
What happens for me with most of the books I've written is that I'm not sure where I'm going as I write. I'm not sure where I might be sure where a scene is going, but I'm not sure what that means for the book.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like Wesley. That's the way he's living his life.
Right. He does. But I didn't know what the ending of Killer Diller would be until I reached the ending or near the ending. I had certain ideas, but it's as if driving in a fog and something emerges from the fog.
Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join us again next week at this time on this radio station. Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Feminism East and West, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for Elizabeth Fox Genovese of Emory University and Bhuthaina Shaban of the University of Damascus. Fox Genovese discusses her recent book, Feminism Without Illusions. Shaban discusses her new book, Both Right and Left-Handed, Arab Women Talk About Their Lives. Feminism in the United States and in the Middle East. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.